Talk about the respiratory system. Be a breath of fresh air, I think you'll find. It's a tale of two gases. We have two gases, and they're going to be what? O2 and CO2. So we have carbon dioxide and carbon... It's carbon dioxide and oxygen. The good stuff is the carbon dioxide or the oxygen. The oxygen. Depends on who you're talking to. If you're a plant, what's the good stuff?
CO2.
CO2. If you're us, oxygen. That's why we're good for each other. Nice symbiotic relationship. So we have two ways of looking at this respiration. It's either external or internal. So we think of all of our respiratory system until we get to the blood. It's going to be external. Once we pass over the membranes of the alveoli, now we're going to be getting into the blood, so we're going to call it internal. So when you take a deep breath in, you're thinking about all external until that oxygen gets into the blood. So when we look here, what would this be considered? External or
internal?
Here?
External.
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 This?
External.
This little small guy?
External.
External, then, until we get into the actual exchange. When we look at this, we see we have an upper and lower respiratory system. Our upper is going to be our schnozzle, our pharynx, our larynx, and also, let's see, so this X marks the spot. The larynx, pharynx. Go below that big black line. Now we're getting into the lower respiratory system. We've got the trachea and the bronchi, the lungs. Think of TB of the lungs, tuberculosis. We've got trachea and a bronchi with the lungs. That's going to be our lower respiratory system. Our nose, we want to get that checked out by a doctor. We go to a what?
ENT.
Yeah. To the O ENT. To the OHLGY. An otorhinolaryngologist. Last week I couldn't say it, and now we have one. So Odo for? External nose has cartilage, like the nasal bones. We know where the nasal bones are, right? Those guys where our glasses sit on, if we carry glasses. Creates a wind tunnel with two holes called the external nares, or the nostrils. We will want to filter air with our schnoz. We'll also detect odors. The resonating chamber. And moisture addition, as well as warm air. So we know that our nose is for men and women. We don't look good without a nose. Here's the root of your nose. There's the bridge where the glasses go. That's where your nasal bone is. The rest of this is all what?
Cartilage.
there's your nasal bone width, it's cartilage. Where does the nasal bone end and the cartilage begin? The femur. The femur where it's bony, and then becomes cartilage. Internal nose anatomy is going to be the nasal cavity divided by the nasal septum. Nasal septum anatomy is perpendicular plate from the ethmoid. It also has a vulvar interior. Septal cartilage is going to be anterior. If you have a problem with this nasal septum, you have a deviated nasal septum. Disorder of the nasal septum, right? So remember that as we look into the skull, we've got this heart-shaped thing right in our frontal bone. You take off your skull, look right in, there's a heart-shaped thing, and that's got holes in it. What's this heart-shaped thing called?
Cribriform or ethmoid bone.
The ethmoid bone, very good. And that, indeed, you're right, those holes are called the cribriform plate. And that's for passage of?
The olfactory.
The olfactory. Nerve. Number one. Cranial nerve one. This, of course, is the frontal bone. So if you go right there, that's where your ethmoid is. You'll have to go back a little bit further back. But it's going to be right there, right? So that's right above your nose. So now if we look at the front view, and we see our skull without a nose, we're looking right in it. Here's your heart-shaped ethmoid. And there's a piece that goes right down from that. A piece that goes right through there. And that's called your... perpendicular plate. Of... the ethmoid. So that's just the top portion of the septum. What we need then is a bottom portion of the septum. Our bottom portion is going to be called the what? Vulva. Just smiling. So we have this septum, top part's called the what? Of? Then you got this thing underneath?
The vulvar.
The vulvar. And they both create the septum. Vulvar is a separate bone by itself. Now the thing is that if you were to look on the side view of an individual, just look at the skull, and there's his teeth. If we look at his nose on the side view, if we could see inside, we would see that these bones sort of go like this. So you got your vulvar, and you got your perpendicular plate, but they're not filling up. It's not like they make the nose. How do you get the rest of the nose? It's going to be all what?
Cartilage.
Cartilage. So here's the perpendicular plate of the what?
Ethmoid.
And there's the vulvar. So look how far deep in that goes without any bone. So to have a deviated septum, usually you could be born with one, or trauma could do it by pushing on the cartilage that ultimately would affect these bones. So how do you fix that? What do they have to do to your nose? Yeah, but break it first, right? So they got to break these bones because these are the guys that have grown wrong. So they got to break them so that they can re-straighten them.
That's for a deviated septum?
Yes. Or if you just want a nose job, they usually don't have to break your bones. Yeah?
Why Yeah, a rhinoplasty. So if you just want to shave off like the front of your nose, for instance, make it more petite. Yes? Bone blasts. Ay, ay, ay. Yeah, there you go. No, because usually they shave off the cartilage in a rhinoplasty. They don't really care about this. This is not going to be cosmetic. If they do anything with that, then it's possible, I guess, the bone could grow back. But usually, as I understand it, they just usually do something with the cartilage. Because most people want a shapelier nose, and that's all here. They usually don't go after the nasal bone. Unless some people have a prominent nasal bone, they may shave that off. But, yeah, good question, because, you know, if you have like a fracture. No, but the thing is you have to have union of bone for it to grow. If you were to just shave off a bone, just keep it like that, I imagine. Or, no, they'll probably put bone on top of it. So they'll shave it off to a point, and then they put like a bone graft on top of it, and that bone will fuse, and then you won't have the problem. So you're going to get bone growth, you're right. But they control that with the bone grafting. And that's what they would do. It's like when they do spinal surgery, they do the same thing. Take off the back of the vertebrae, then just put some of the bone back, so you have a fusion there. So that's what they would do. But I don't know that they really go that deep for a bone. They might. I don't know. So air enters the nostril first, then the vestibule. Nasal concha creates the meatus, or meatusi, whatever. We have a superior, middle, and inferior nasal concha. Extends from the lateral nose wall like shelves. Between these shelves are spaces called the meati. So you have your nose coming here. What you see is like shelves sticking out. And that's called the inferior nasal concha. This is the middle. And then the upper one, you can't see, that's going to be your superior. Sides of your nose is this inferior nasal concha that's a bone all by itself. A bone alone. But the other two guys are going to be part of the perpendicular plate. So they're going to be part of the ethmoid. And what they are is they're shelves. So you got these shelves, and then you have air flowing over the shelves. And the shelves have mucous membranes on them. They also have very vascular, so you got a good vascular supply. So as the air flies through over the shelves, it cools the air or warms it?
Warms it.
Also, the sticky mucus does what?
Filters out
the dust and everything else. Exactly. That's why periodically you may just sneeze for no reason. You don't have a cold. You just sneeze because something's got into that area, and body doesn't like it, so you sneeze. You ever seen a picture of a sneeze? It's like, goes out like this. It's great. Let's see a picture of a sneeze. Sneeze. Well, Wikipedia has sneeze. Wikipedia has everything. There it is. Yeah. All those H1N1s flying around. And this is a good one. Look at this, guys. Yeah. This one's cool. It's an Asian version. Must be some other one, good ones. I don't think I've seen this one before. John sneezes. Yikes.
Is there a video?
Is there a video? Is there one on the video? Is there a video? Sneeze video? No. Ooh, that's a good one. Obama sneezing. That's no sneeze. He laughs when he sneezes? Figures. He can do anything. Video blog? No. Okay. Where were we, guys? Alright, so we're going to go through the olfactory epithelium. Cranial nerve 1, as we said, is going to meet the air. That's why we can smell stuff. We also have goblet cells. That's where we're going to be getting our what from?
Mucus.
Our mucus. And then we go into the pharynx on our way to the lungs. Olfactory mucosa lines the roof of the nasal cavity. Respiratory mucosa lines the rest of the nasal cavity. So we have this pseudo-stratified ciliated epithelium. Remember what cilia are? Hair-like projections. Goblet cells, we also have lysosomes there. Our nostrils will go from right to left depending on how many ions we're supposed to have. So our nostrils will often be a little bit closed on one side or open on the other, and that's normal. Just depending on what's going on. If we're in this environment, what kind of ions are more here, positive or negative? Positive. More positive ions in like, you know, around machines and stuff like that. You go out in the woods, though, what are the most prevalent? Negative ions. So if you have too many negative ions, like here, your right nostril probably will not work as well as your left, because you want to bring in more negative ions. So is that true? Feel like you're breathing more on the left? Think? Breathing at all? You're not breathing out of either. She's got a cold. Okay, when we look at the pharynx,
see, we're going to have three portions to it. If we were to eat something, we shouldn't have to get it into the nasal pharynx because it's going to be communicating with the nose. But when we do eat something, it should go into the oral pharynx, obviously the mouth. And finally, we're going to get into the laryngeal pharynx. Naso, oral, or laryngeal. Depending on where we are. So food's going to go into the oral, down the laryngeal. Hopefully then into the esophagus. What is this thing called?
Superior.
The contact. No, superior. Superior. Middle. And inferior. Very good. kind of epithelium would we expect to find here? Pseudo. Carex functions, passageway for food and air. So food and air are going to be going in there as well as water. So you see there's going to be a passageway for air. Air in the throat mouth and also for food. The resonating chamber, also mean functions such as the consonants are going to be found right there. Superior portion is an opening for the eustachian tube. You remember what the eustachian tube is?
The link between the pharynx to the ear.
To the ear. That's what part of the ear? Middle ear. Equalize the pressure, right? So if you're going up in an airplane, you'd want to open up your mouth to stimulate this area so that you could equalize pressure on the inside, pressure on the outside. The inferior portion connects to the esophagus and the larynx. So we have a food and an air tube. So we have a little bit of an inherent problem. And that problem is that food could go where? Where the air is supposed to go. That could go there. And that can't be good. It's got to go there. You want to go in the trachea. You want to go into the esophagus. How are you going to stop that? You're going to stop it with this thing. Epiglottis. This area is called the glottis. So if you have something on top of it, you're going to call it the what?
Epiglottis.
In addition, glottis means tongue. So it's going to be a tongue on top, isn't it? On top of the trachea. We see that right here, epiglottis. A small tongue-like structure that when we swallow, the epiglottis closes over the larynx, so the food will not go into the esophagus. So we have this little thing, this epiglottis. As we swallow, it has to come up and close. So it has to rise and close. That's why if you touch your Adam's apple and then swallow. Look.
Rise.
So we've got to stop our saliva from going into our what?
The trachea.
So that's why it rises and closes.
But if the tongue pressing up against the roof of the mouth, that makes that happen,
all
right?
The tongue going up against the roof of the mouth, closing off what part?
Nasal.
The nasal pharynx, right? Tongue comes back, closes that off. Then, as the bolus comes down, then that triggers the closure. So it's really coming from the larynx place. We'll talk about that. And there are cartilages around the whole pharynx, and they're going to be cartilage that's going to be like in a C shape. And the C is going to be open towards the posterior. We have 9 pieces of this. The thyroid cartilage is also called the what?
Adam's apple.
Adam's apple. Or the Eve's apple. Males bigger because of the testosterone, but both males and females have a thyroid cartilage. Lower, just off of the thyroid cartilage is the cricoid cartilage. So if you follow that very front portion of the thyroid cartilage, you slide down, you slide posterior as you slide, and you meet the little bump. That little bump is the what? That's the cricoid. The space between the thyroid and the cricoid is where you'd want to do a puncture of a person's, I've got a problem with my food stuck. This food is going to be stuck where? In the nasal pharynx?
No.
The oral pharynx? Or in the laryngeal
pharynx?
Laryngeal, yeah. You're just going to get it stuck right there, or right here. If you get stuck there, your thyroid cartilage is right there. So just go just below that. Put something in there, now air is getting in. Because it's stuck right there. I think that's stuck in the larynx. Okay, the house is the vocal cords, that's our larynx, so if we just put our hand on there and we speak or do anything, we feel it rotating or vibrating.
right, and that's going to be our vocal cords. So here we have our what?
Thyroid.
Cartilage. Slide off this thyroid cartilage into this bump. Or the what?
Ricoid.
Go just above that, and that's the area where we want to puncture.
Tracheotomy.
So we have a real thin membrane there that we can pierce, and also the vascularity is more lateral, so it really won't bleed much either, which is a positive thing. To save a life is cool. The epiglottis, of course, is going to be that. It's going to go over the trachea. Just a side view of the epiglottis.
I've seen people with a hole, like, even lower, and like, down.
Like a permanent stoma.
Yeah.
If it had lung disease or something like that. Or laryngeal surgery or something like that.
How deep do you go in the trachea?
Oh, not very deep. Because you're not concerned about going to the back. Yeah. The pin works really good. I've never done one before. So there's your cartilage, C shape. Rings, we talked about nine pieces of cartilage. Why do you suppose they're C-shaped, first of all? Why not just round? And why does the C point posterior, not anterior or side? Exactly. So the esophagus is going to be posterior, right?
Yeah.
Esophagus is there. So you have these cartilages that are open posteriorly. Any food that comes by will be able to just be pushed against. You won't have this, like, every time you swallow, you'd have, like, a, you know, upsetting experience. You'd be bumping against these. So thyroid cartilage, we're talking about thyroid cartilage with the tracheus, and that's how you do the trach. So you're coming right off the what cartilage?
Thyroid
cartilage. Go to above what cartilage?
Cricoid.
Of course, you want, only want to do this in extreme emergencies. When would be the best time to do this?
When you choke the chain.
Well, first you already choked, right? What's a universal sign of choking? Is it
purple?
No, if they're choking.
No sound at all.
No sound at all.
Yeah.
And they look at you like this.
Yeah.
And they're upset?
No.
Yeah, they're upset. Can't think of anything more upsetting. Then they're going to pass out, aren't they? Of course, you already called 911. They passed out. How much time do we have after they passed out?
Up to 4 minutes. 4 or 5 minutes.
5 minutes. So you'll get your watch. 3 minutes are passing. The person's passed out. They're turning blue. False and vestibular folds.
So as we close these guys together, we then will be able to speak. Because we have this arrangement that we are one of the few animals that can speak and articulate, we will tend to have problems with food getting stuck in this area. Dogs cannot choke. They cannot not breathe if they eat. You ever notice your dog eating? He's going to go this big. And they're gone. Sometimes I go, they'll never choke like we do. The brick is never going to be shut off. They don't have this whole intricate system. Even though they can talk, they speak. They still can't. Can't choke. I don't mean choke. What would be the term for that? Your, like, universal choke sign? What's the difference between that and... Yeah. What's a term for it, though, if you're choking? But if you're not choking, because you're obstruction, I guess obstruction. I can't get obstructions. But they can't talk. The trachea or the windpipe, so the anterior to the esophagus, as we know.
We have those C-shaped hyaline cartilages.
As I said, we're going to be able to allow food to go down there. So our esophagus is this collapsed tube. It then opens up, allowing food to pass. As we go past our trachea, we get into our primary bronchi.
Dr. Sutton, sorry to stop you. Go back to your slides.
Yes.
It says the first bullet point, the larynx forms compared to bowl superior, called the ventricular bowl.
Yes.
Is it the vestibular?
Oh, no, it should be vestibular folds. You're right. Yeah. Good catch. I got to change that. Send me an email.
Okay.
Do it. Good catch.
So, secondarily then, we have our secondary tubule, or secondary bronchi. And then we have our tertiary. These are going to lead into the bronchioles, which will ultimately go to the alveolar ducts, and then to the alveoli. So we can't see those guys. Nor can we really see our bronchioles that well. So we have our primary, secondary, tertiary, and then our bronchioles. Now as you look at this, if an individual were to have they were to aspirate something, what would that mean?
Something in their lungs, they got food in their lungs. Or let's say they took a vitamin pill and they, instead of swallowing, they hiccuped and they went into their lungs, let's say, or whatever. Where would it go probably? Where would it go? So here we are at the alveolar ducts. That's our ducts going into these things called the alveoli. Alveoli are little sacs. Would we say that this area is going to be external or internal respiration?
External.
This?
External.
When it passes through? Notice how wide really vascular, these guys are. Beautiful, isn't it? So we have deoxygenated blood coming in, it's becoming oxygenated. These things that are coming in to the alveoli are called pulmonary blood. Arteries, so they're going away from the heart, right? These guys that are oxygenated are called the what? The veins.
So it becomes internal only when it hits the capillary network?
Yes, when it passes through.
Yeah, it's had the gas exchange.
Okay, so here's a review. We go from our nose to our pharynx, to our larynx, to our trachea, to our bronchi, and finally to our lungs. So fear layer trades bronchos. Remember that? I guess you get a good deal from Larry on bronchos. Fair deal, anyways. Histology is going to be our pseudostratified epithelium, as we talked about. Ciliate covers the nose to the terminal bronchioles. So the pseudo goes from the nose to the small holes. Basically, we have cartilage all the way until we reach the alveoli. That's why we can have such symptoms as bronchial constriction or asthma. There is a way for these to become constricted. Also, we have some other diseases that are going to be affecting these, such as emphysema. It actually destroys the integrity of these sacs. They get too ballooned out, they don't become elastic enough, and of course you're going to have problems with respiration. So the lungs are paired, cone-shaped organs in the thoracic cavity separated by the mediastinum. What was the mediastinum? Remember what the mediastinum was? Middle part? Got the heart in there? Thymus? Each lung is going to be surrounded by a pleural membrane, or membranes going to protect and enclose the lungs. This is very similar to the membrane that's around your heart. Around your heart, what's the what? Pericardium, right? You had a pleural portion there, if you remember. You also had a visceral portion. So too do we have this in our lungs. The pleura is going to be containing those two portions. Pleura is going to be both the parietal pleura and the visceral pleura. Which one's going to be around the lungs?
Parietal.
So it's going to be touching and hugging the lungs. The visceral. Which is going to be the one that's going to be outside of the visceral. Parietal. So the pleura does not totally cover the lungs. But we have to make a distinction between the parietal or visceral pleura. So one does cover the lungs totally. That's going to be called the what? Visceral. The other one, called the what? Does not totally cover the lungs. Let's find this. Here's our pleura. The pleura is two portions. What? Visceral pleura. And idle plura. The plura totally covers the lung. We're talking about this being the plura.
Totally covers the lung. Agreed?
The visceral, we separate it out. The visceral totally covers the lung. Does the parietal. This is the visceral. Plural. This is the what? Yes, the light pink, the whole thing. So all this is visceral. And all the purple, darker purple, that's all what? That's all parietal. So the parietal plural does not cover the lung totally.
And the visceral expands into the inhaler?
Yes. It actually expands into the parietal area. Right? We call it the pleural cavity. So obviously, someone would ask, what's it going to be like on the test? I would say, does the pleura totally cover the lungs? And you would say?
Yes.
If I say, does the visceral pleura totally cover the lungs? You would say?
Yes.
But if I said, does the parietal pleura cover the lungs? You would say?
No.
No way, Jose. You go, wait a minute. Doesn't this totally cover the lung? At that space, it doesn't cover the bottom part, so it doesn't totally cover the lung. So why is this important? Well, if we wanted to take a biopsy of the fluid, if there's any effusion from the lungs, let's say a person has pulmonary edema, for instance, we may want to check out what that fluid has in it. Is it due to a bacterial infection? Is it due to a heart problem? Is it due to cancer? Is it due to whatever? So why would there be a fusion? So how are we going to take that fluid? Are we going to actually take a needle and stick it into the lung itself? What happens when you make a hole that communicates with the inside of the lung? Pneumothorax, yes. Pneumo means what?
Air.
Air. And thorax, obviously this, right? Air in the thorax, what happens to the lung? It collapses. So you don't want to do that as a normal course. What do you call that in medicine? Malpractice. You get sued for that kind of thing. So where would you want to take then a sample of the fluid?
Pleural
cavity, yeah. You put it right in there. There's a needle in there, and that's where it should be. I don't think it matters. Yeah, the lungs aren't going to go all the way in down there. So you probably do it there. Because they still got to breathe while you're doing it. But, yeah. Okay. So that's called a thoracentesis. They go in and take out the fluid. The pleural cavity or the space. Also, there's a cavity between the what and the what?
Visceral and parietal.
Visceral and parietal.
So what happens is that you got these two surfaces, and the two membranes slide when we breathe. So when we breathe in, it's going to be sliding. When we breathe out, it's going to be sliding. They have this fluid between them, so that's good. There's that fluid that's allowing us to slide.
Remember? Are you talking about the two lungs?
Yeah. Well, no, no. It's that the sides are sliding. So as you breathe in, they're going to slide. And as you breathe out, they're going to slide. So we're sliding. Yeah, this, it's the visceral and the parietal sliding against each other. Okay. Then there's also a pressure gradient that's been created from these two guys sticking together. Okay. The lower pressure assists in the inflation of the lungs. The two membranes adhere to each other. This is as if there's like a stickiness. And they also compartmentalize. It helps to separate infection. Because as we don't see here, but as we look at another, look at the lung, we'll see that there's going to be separations. And separations are going to compartmentalize things. And then finally, we've got easy friction between the two membranes. There's that space. This is very similar to what we talked about with the heart. And we said there was the pericardium, the fibrous outer layer, remember? Their visceral layer, the cavity between, pericardial cavity, remember? So they're similar to that. So then this would be why, if you do have a blow to the lung itself, you now have a higher pressure on the inside, so you expect the lung to collapse. That's why you would try to close up the hole, if the hole was made, like let's say a guy got, you know, stabbed in his lung. You close up the hole, and then just have them breathe, right? The lung then should expand on itself, and then what would happen to the visceral and parietal pleura? Expand and connect together, right? And all these things would then be fulfilled again. The fluid would be there, we'd have the adherence, we'd have the pressure gradient maintained, and the lung would no longer be collapsed. So to remember this, remember that it slides, there's a pressure gradient, it adheres, it also is compartmentalizing, it eases, so together we have it being a space. Space. Probably in the pleural cavity. Now, pleurisy. Pleurisy is a word that's, I guess, in common usage. It doesn't go according to our typical way of saying things in anatomy. If we have inflammation of things, we say it's what? Some kind of itis.
But the inflamed lungs are not called an itis, but rather they're called pleurisy. So, go figure. Pleurisy is inflammation of the pleural membrane. Initially, the pleurisy can become painful because you get friction between the two membranes. So we know the hallmark of inflammation is what? So you can actually listen to that person breathes in, and you hear it sort of like that. It's like, so if you take your hair and do that, it's like sort of crackling. It's
you know they have pleurisy. But the problem is, some of them won't get attention. They won't get it taken care of. And what will happen is, the other components of inflammation will occur, such as redness, which you cannot see, but you then do get swelling later on. Now you have this stuff adhering, they're in pain when they breathe in, now you get swelling. What happens to the pleural membrane? It starts to separate. Now the pain's gone. They feel better. But are they better? Bless you. So, which pleural layer does not totally cover the lung? So which pleural membrane does not entirely cover the lungs? Parietal. The two parts of the pleural membrane do or do not totally cover the lung? The two parts. They do not. Very good. We're clear on that.
The two parts, both of them. No.
Oh.
Only one, both of them together.
Don't go there, bud.
Okay, I won't.
No, don't go there. When we say two parts, we're talking about the visceral and the parietal. And two together do not totally cover the lungs. If it was visceral, yes. If it was parietal, doesn't. But two together,
no.
Okay. Each lung extends from the diaphragm inferiorly to the clavicle superiorly. So it's going from here all the way to there. Conveniently, we have a base that's going to be bigger, apex, smaller. Nice, huh? Unlike the heart. We have a costal surface, not coastal, but costal surface, which is going to lie against the ribs. Mediastinal surface is going to be medial or lateral? Mediastinum, right? Medium. Medium. We have a hilus. It's going to be a passage for our blood vessels and stuff. We have a cardiac notch in the left lung only for the heart. So which lung is smaller?
Left.
Left. And why?
The heart.
Yes, we need the heart.
Why?
Because the heart's there.
We have a cardiac notch. The heart's sticking in here. That makes the left a smaller lung. What's that? Here is those areas we talked about with compartmentalization that the pleura allows for. So if an infection were to just get in this area, we would not be able to proceed to the other areas. That's a nice thing. We have three lobes on the left lung. We have two on the right. Easy to remember because the right one's bigger, right? It has more lobes. What I would never do is take an x-ray of a person's lungs, because they're useless to me. Because you can't figure it out. This does not just stay there. It's not like it goes straight through. It actually goes up a little bit in the back. This one, I'm not sure what it does. I think it goes down or it goes up. So you could look at a lesion, for instance, here, like there. It could be in the upper lobe of the lung, even though it looks like it's in the middle lobe. It's very difficult to figure out long x-rays, so I never did. Except one time. One time I had this patient who came in, and she had this cough, and she said that she had just been to her dentist about 2 weeks before. And that's when the cough started. So I figured, well, I don't know, maybe irritated something. Maybe, but for 2 weeks, it didn't make any sense. So she said, you know, the funny thing was about him, he's a real nice guy, I've been going to him forever. But he's never said this before. And he said, oops. And I said, oops. Yeah, oops, and he seemed concerned. But I didn't know. So she should have asked him why. So I said, well, you know, just for yucks, let's just take an x-ray. So I take an x-ray and I see this this thing that looks strikingly like a tooth sitting right there.
What do you have?
A tooth. You pull off her crown, and he went, oops, and that's when he lost it. Oh. Or lost it and said, oops. So it went down her trachea and went into her mouth.
You didn't say anything to her?
I guess not. So, and you can see it really readily, because a piece of metal sticking in the lung, I mean, it just glows. And it looked like a tooth. So I said, well, you have a real problem here. She said, what is it? I said, you have a tooth in your lung. I said, really? I said, yeah. So what should I do? I said, you got to go to a thoracic surgeon. So she went to a thoracic surgeon, and they go in with like a little cage. You go in, and then they just nab it, and they just pull it up. And it was about, you know, this big. And they have all this mucus and stuff around the body's trying to wall it off.
But they went down the tree?
Yeah, they go right down, and then they go right to the bronchi and pull it right up.
Wow. Did she
sue him? Yeah. Well, she did. She's a nice older woman. But she didn't get dental health care for the rest of her life. But I was saying to her, that's nice, but do you really want to go back? He paid for the thoracic surgery.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand how it could happen. I mean, he's been to a dentist, and they have the person helping him out. He probably thought that he got sucked up in that machine. Well, I think you can check out the machine, can't you? I don't know anything about that, but like a vacuum, I think. Can't you go in there and look at it? Bronchi, very good. Yes.
If you look at the angle, something's going to fall down. Is it going to go or is it going to go
straight down?
Yeah, it's going to go straight that way. It's not going to take this angle over. So when you aspirate anything, it's probably going to go into the right lung. Which is probably better, given the fact you only have two lobes over here, right? Is there a spare one, maybe? I don't know.
Why to the right?
Well, why do that? Because of the nice angle. So. Yeah, less of an angle. Whereas this is,
straight
that sort of goes to the other side.
Is that whole part of the left lung a lobe? That one big thing is?
Yeah.
One of the two lobes?
Yeah, this fissure goes way back here. But yeah, this is the whole front of it.
So some muscles involved in respiration, really the big trick is to breathe in. Once you breathe in, then the rest of the story is basically over. So you really need the energy to breathe in. It really is a recoil for you to breathe out. So expiration is really just a recoil. You can assist respiration or expiration, but basically inspiration is going to be, the big guy is going to be the diaphragm. The diaphragm is going to be the big one to cause inspiration. And we know what happens, our diaphragm goes where?
Down.
It goes in your abdomen.
So as we breathe in, it goes into your abdomen.
Diaphragm. Good trip. Going to go in to your abdomen. In your abdomen. As you in what?
Exhale.
As you exhale,
course, is your diaphragm. So when we have our diaphragm coming down, what does that do to the chest?
It's more moving.
It's expanding. You got it. Now that it's expanded, all that has to happen is the ribs and everything's holding it together, your sternum, all that has to happen is they got to relax, right? So the big push, literally, is to open up our thoracic area. And then all we got to do is just not do anything, just
relax.
And then it's going to come back down. It's like a recoil. So the big thing we need is our diaphragm. And our diaphragm comes from, you remember, the cervical spine. It's controlled by C3, 4, and 5. These are the roots, the nerves. It's the nerve roots. And we remember that C3, 4, and 5 does what?
Keeps you alive.
Keeps the diaphragm alive. C3, 4, and 5 keeps the diaphragm alive. So if you don't have C3, 4, and 5, then you're not going to have your diaphragm working. You can try to have your scalenes assist you. The scalenes, as you remember, are side muscles. You're going to go to the first and second ribs, so they're going to be able to elevate those ribs to try to get your expansion. We also have the external intercostals. If you remember, we have our ribs that come in. As you remember, you have your sternum. The ribs are coming into them, if you remember. So between the ribs is going to be the intercostal. Intercostal muscles. They're going to be sort of making a crisscross. One's external, one's internal. So they're attaching to the ribs. So as they contract, they're either going to allow the ribs to fall down or the ribs to get up. As we breathe in, we use the external intercostals. Because the external intercostals are going outward, so we want them to do what? Pull up and out, you got it? Okay. We're also going to use the pec minor, you remember where that is? Ribs 5, 4, and 3, attaches to the coracoid process. We're going to raise those ribs. That's going to be an assistance. Also remember the sternocleidomastoid. That's going to also raise, remember, because it attaches to the clavicle and sternum. That's going to try to raise up. Remember the platysma. This guy. So you may see an individual who has respiratory compromise, they're trying to get their chest open, and you'll see maybe that they look sort of like the creature from The Lost Lagoon. Because he's using everything he can to try to raise his ribcage. That's no problem if he can do that, because then he doesn't have to do anything, right?
And that's when I have to sit in a certain position to breathe?
Sometimes. So the internal intercostals are going to assist in expiration. And also, contraction of the abdominal muscles can also assist in that. But really, these are minor, as we've said. It's really just relaxation. It's less effort, definitely, to breathe out. So when we look at the intercostal muscles, we remember that the external intercostals mm-hmm.
opposed to inham, where the internal, yes. They're going to allow us to exhale. So we see dramatically that there is a opposite. So just remember that the internals do exactly the opposite of what you would think. That's it.
Inhale. And the reason is because, as we said, it's going to be more external. When they contract, they're going to raise the rib cage up. So just remember the external intercostals help us inhale, and the external intercostals help us to exhale. No. Internals,
external to exhale.
Exhale, and the externals to inhale. Also called inhalation. It's going to expand the lungs as air goes in. Inhalation, expanding the lungs. Diaphragm contracts, comes down, pulls everything in. Got negative there, pulls in the air. And then the opposite happens, diaphragm goes up, air goes up. We're feeling good. So on inspiration, lungs are going to expand. Diaphragm's going in the abdomen. Expiration, just the opposite is happening. Notice we mentioned that it's a passive process with elastic recoil. These are going to be holding to the gas laws. And one of the laws is Boyle's law. I have Boyle's law here. I do. Oh, one interesting analogy that they often mention. The analogy of the bucket handle and the ribs. The idea is that during inspiration, the ribs move upward and outward, like a bucket handle. So in inspiration, the ribs are coming up and out. Whereas just the opposite in inspiration, they're also coming down, as if the bucket were coming down. I never use that because it really doesn't do anything for me. Doesn't do anything for you either? I never used it before, but they use it classically all over the place. So whatever. Just talk about Boyle's law. It's one of the most important of the gas laws. What we have is a liter, let's call a liter bottle of air. And what we're going to do is realize it's going to have one atmosphere as far as pressure. The amount of pressure that this is exerting is one. So if we were to push on this column of air, and make it go half of what it was before, so now we have half a liter of volume, that's going to increase our pressure. It's going to double it. So the idea is that there's an inverse proportion of the amount of pressure and the amount of volume. So the volume of gas varies inversely with pressure. So here's our volume, increase our pressure. Now we've got less volume. So how can we use this? Well, let's say we're going to somewhere that has more pressure, such as?
High altitudes.
High altitudes, we have more pressure, therefore we feel that we have less air in us, right?
Is there less air where there's higher altitude?
No.
Yes.
Yes, anyways. So you got less air, number one. Then you got more pressure on you, so now you got two things happening.
Can I talk to you for a minute?
So if we have less volume, then we of course are going to feel like we have more volume, we have literally the same volume, but it's less, is it more volume or less?
Less volume, more pressure.
Yeah, but didn't we start off with
low pressure?
More volume, more pressure.
No, but isn't this really this in less space?
Yeah,
but
that's Miami and that's Denver.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is this is 1 liter.
It's the same volume, but it's more concentrated.
Ah. So even though our volume has decreased, and that's the reason we increased our pressure, right?
Right.
What do we feel like here, though? Do we feel like we still have as much volume? It doesn't feel like that in our lungs.
Yeah,
you're out of breath. Because you got that increased pressure. So that's going to be Boyle's Law. We can sort of use that if we're going to go, you know, like scuba diving or whatever else. Also, we have Dalton's Law. Use to calculate partial pressures of different gases. As you know, if we were to look at our air now, what would our air be? Just oxygen? It's also what?
Nitrogen.
Carbon. Silicon? Okay. Silicon? What else? If we got oxygen, we must have carbon dioxide too, right? Well, although you mentioned carbon, so it's going to be carbon dioxide. So we have our air, and so our air here is going to be carbon dioxide, oxygen, we're going to have silicon, we're going to have a little nitrogen maybe. What else did we mention? Some hydrogen. Okay, so this is our air. This is our air. And we've got all these guys. These gases probably are going to have a different response to pressure, you think? Yeah. So that's why we call each of these partial pressure. So we would use Dalton's Law to try to determine what the total pressure of this air would be given our different what? Partial pressures. It's called Dalton's Law. Henry's Law is going to be regarding gas will stay in a solution if you have increased pressure. So if we have a soda can, or let's, oh better, champagne. You know, you look at champagne, you look at the nice bottle of champagne, and there's a lot of bubbles in it initially. Few. Now you open up the cork, what happens? Yeah, it comes out almost, right? Bubbles over, literally. So that's because you have the carbon dioxide in the solution, right? And then you're letting out the pressure that then brings the carbon dioxide out of solution. So that's according to Henry's Law. So how can we use Henry's Law?
Underwater.
Good. What about underwater? Coming up? Good. Coming up what? Surface. Suppose you come up slow, is there a problem? Suppose you come up fast. What's the problem? You get a Mercedes, right? Get a Mercedes? Yeah, you get a Mercedes if you come up too fast. Well, you get a Benz anyways, but maybe not a Mercedes necessarily. So you get the bends, right? And what is the bends? It bends over?
Isn't it like nitrogen bubbling?
Yes, it's nitrogen. Nitrogen gas in your blood. How'd it get there? Pressure? So you have your blood. It's like a soda can or a bottle of champagne. You have lots of pressure on it. You get nitrogen in there. Because it got lots of pressure, just like it got lots of pressure on the champagne. Keeps the gas inside, right? Okay. You're down really, really low. The nitrogen goes into your blood. Now you come up too fast. The nitrogen can't get out. What do you get?
little bubbles of nitrogen. Is that good? What do we call something that's in blood? It's not supposed to be there. Call it an embolism.
Is that the same thing you get on an airplane?
Yeah.
What is it? You just like blow it up, and when you're on a flight, you just stomach just.
No, it's not enough pressure.
What is that?
But I'm not sure what that is. Circulation. Indigestion from a bad food. Too many peanuts. Not eat? That's right, that's true.
Isn't that when they tell you should like walk around them? But that's even the,
no.
They toss them in the
right? Oh, well that's the DVT thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you walk around, you prevent the DVTs, but no, this is something different. So you come up too fast because you had this high pressure. Usually if you dive deep, I guess over, I don't know how many feet, but so that's going to cause embolism of these. So what you need to do is be in a chamber where they'll bring you down to that same atmospheric pressure, then they bring you up slowly, and then what will happen to the gas?
It escapes.
It'll just escape, yeah. Okay. Then we have Stoddard's Law, which is never stand behind a patient who has what? Stoddard's Law. Okay. The Valsalva maneuver. The Valsalva maneuver is forced expiration. It's not so, you know, in chiropractic, the thing is that you have to, like, lay people on their side sometimes to put their bones back in place. So I don't do that. I did another technique. But I had this friend, and I was shadowing him, just watching how he adjusts people. He's quite a character. So one time, he lays this guy on his side, and you know he's over him, you know, and he's doing this chiropractic thing, you know, and then the guy farts. So he looks at him straight face, and he says, "Don't worry, when you get my bill, then you'll shit." He wasn't a guy you want to go for practice billing, by any means. So what is a Valsalva maneuver? It is a force expiration that we stop. So we would say to the patient, bear down as if you're having a bowel movement, but don't. So that would be a Valsalva maneuver. And it's called a VM, but it's not a BM for bowel movement. Okay, we also have tidal volume. This is going to be the volume in one breath. That's what we measured with our what? Barometers. Our spirometer is going to be measuring the volumes. We can do that in a variety of ways. Spiro, of course, means breath. So, dum spiro, spero, while I breathe, I have hope. As long as we have breath, we have hope. Some respiratory terms, we have hyperventilation,
rapid and deep breathing, exhale. This increases more CO2. Now, I don't get that. Why would you breathe in more? Increase your CO2. When you think you'll get more oxygen in?
Maybe an exhale.
So it's not exchanging.
Ah, we're not exchanging.
Yeah, you're not breathing
it all
the way
in. Right. Our air is not exchanging. Our oxygen is really not being exchanged, right? So we're really building up more carbon dioxide. It's as if we're not breathing as well as we should, right? Because we're not. We're not taking good breaths in, good breaths out. So too much CO2 is going to cause acidosis. That's from hypercapnia, which is too much CO2. Now, why would hypercapnia or too much CO2 cause acidic blood?
It's a reaction, I guess.
Yes. What is that reaction? Don't make me write it.
I don't want to write it. Acidosis from what?
Yes. Same thing as the stomach.
Sodium. Increase in a certain
sodium.
H2O. Plus.
CO2.
Yields
two, C, O.
Was that the stomach acid?
Three?
The stomach acid, right?
No. This is called what?
Carbonic
acid. Remember we talked about that in the blood? Remember we talked about the blood? Yeah, and this is what enzyme? Carbonic. Something or other. What is it? Carbonic something. I don't know. Forget it. Doesn't matter. Okay. Oh, anhydrase, I think. Carbonic anhydrase, maybe. Okay, so if we have increased CO2, of course water is always around, then we're going to be getting that carbonic acid. If this dissociates, is that going to be a big acid? I mean, as big as acid as this guy?
No.
No, because it's going to dissociate just in hydrous chlorine, right? So it's not a really powerful acid, but what is our basic blood pH supposed to be? 7.4. That's not really that basic, is it? No. But if we shift it a little bit that way, the body's not going to like that. Yeah, it's going to be more acidic, exactly. So that's the problem with too much carbon dioxide. Hypoventilation, slow and shallow breathing, should cause what? Decrease our CO2 and increase our oxygen, right? So if a person's hyperventilating, what do you want them to do?
Slow down.
Slow down, yeah. Give them a paper bag to breathe in, something like that. And hypoxia, we're very familiar with that. Cyanosis is going to be a sign of problems with the lungs, extreme problems with the lungs. Soon we're going to say what to the person? Sayonara. Cyanosis will soon cause sayonara. Primary effect of hypoxia, of course, is that the tissue's not going to get enough oxygen, so you're going to have tissue what? Necrosis. In pneumothorax we talked about, we said that there's going to be a loss of the negative interpleural pressure, right? The pleural membranes are going to not stick, and what's going to happen? It's going to collapse. We fix that by fixing the hole and then allowing for inspiration, right? And that should fix it. Some lung diseases. We talked about asthma before.
Hypersensitivity reaction. Get wheezing.
Anxiety, because they're afraid they're not going to be able to breathe. Then we have a phenomenon called COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. You may have seen people on TV saying, I can breathe better. The little signs. Have you seen this? Or I can do more golf. Because they're taking some drug, you know. Because they have COPD. What is COPD, but?
Well, what? If it's chronic, it means what?
It's been there for a long time.
It's been there a lot. Obstructive?
Yeah.
What is what's going to be obstructive?
Airway.
Airway, specifically?
Bronchioles,
or maybe even the alveoli. And the pulmonary, of course, is self-explanatory. So when we look at COPD, what we're looking at is a chronic situation that hasn't been corrected. So we're going to be having a confluence of different things to create COPD. So we'll have, for instance, a chronic asthma. We may have a chronic bronchitis. We may have a chronic emphysema. And if the chronicity of any of these increases, then we get this thing. And that thing in the middle where they all intersect is called what?
COPD.
So there's a number of roads to getting to COPD, but they all share the one word, which is chronic.
So they're all three of those are subdivisions of COPD?
All those are going to
come to COPD if they remain chronic. It's like a way to get there. So we know what asthma is. That's going to be chronic inflammation and obstruction. You can see how that could cause chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, right? Same with emphysema. We see that we have the alveoli being destructive. We have alveoli is no longer working well. The individual is not going to be able to do our external or internal respiration. Internal respiration, right? So they're going to have enough internal, so now what's going to happen to your system? Exactly, you're not getting enough oxygen, so you're going to be getting that blueness. You're also going to get a barrel chest. Why?
Trying to
get air in, exactly. As much as you can. Then we have chronic bronchitis. This is going to be excessive mucus and cough
in the bronchi, right? Bronchitis. So any of those are going to ultimately cause an obstructive process, as you can see. Here is a pink puffer and a blue bloater. The pink puffer is from emphysema, and the blue bloater is from chronic bronchitis. Emphysema has a P in it, so we think of a pink puffer. Chronic bronchitis has a B in it, so we think of a blue bloater. So either one's bad news. Notice that we see here that his neck looks a little bit webbed. What from? Also, you really see his SCMs. You even see his scalenes. He's really trying to breathe as best he can. And here would be a normal alveoli if we cut them. Normally, nice walls. This, filled with fluid and bad stuff. That's our pneumonia. That would be a local inflammation. But then we could think of this as sort of like what happens with which one of those three?
Bronchitis,
exactly, you got it. And then this last one's going to be where the wall is actually breaking of the alveoli. This would be, of course, emphysema. So they're going to compensate by trying to breathe in. Decreased surface area, they got some problems. Now, pneumonia is going to be an acute inflammation of the alveoli. Bacterial infection. We said that bugs don't cause disease, and yet this is a bacterial infection. So how did the person get the infection? Immune system is compromised, right? Then we have them take antibiotics. Do the antibiotics kill the bacteria?
They stop them from reproducing and recurring.
Good. So do they kill the bacteria?
No.
No. What kills the bacteria?
Macrophages.
Our immune system. Our immune system comes on the job. Right, the macrophages. So our reason for taking an antibiotic would be to decrease the level of bacteria so that your body can take over, right? If you don't have the antibiotic, the bug may get ahead of the body and you die. You don't want that. So you decrease the bacteria to the point where the immune system now can take over. And tuberculosis is going to be a problem with the lungs. They actually get these little lesions in the lungs of bacteria, so it's a bacterial infection. And it causes consumption. That's the term, other term for it, because the person wastes away. Because they just not able to function with that. In the old days, they used to go to sanitariums. Not because they were insane, but because they were very sanitary. The idea was the more sanitary you got, then the better your condition was going to be. And they would do such things as, you know, natural stuff, like, you know, put you out in the sunlight. I thought that sunlight was a cure for vitamins. We put them on usually natural diets. But that's how Kellogg started. Kellogg had a sanitarium. And he wanted to have healthful foods. Cornflakes are very healthy. So he came up with the cornflake thing. That's why he has the That's why they have this cereal now called Kellogg's. Most of their cereals aren't very good, as you know. At least that was where it came from. He's trying to make a convenience food that he could make there and then also give to his patients when they left. Very good book on that, by the way, it's called On the Road to Wellville. Did you hear that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about that whole thing, the whole healthy thing. Couldn't have sex, that was bad. Yeah, couldn't eat meat, that was bad. And all natural, organic sort of stuff, you know. And they thought that was a cure for it. But it turns out, all you need is antibiotics and that cures it. But they didn't trust that then. TB or not TB? That is the consumption. Consumption is done about it? Of cough. Of cough. TB or not TB? In terms of inspiration, need a lift. This guy goes by, he's hitchhiking. He's got his guitar on his back. And he's hitchhiking, you know. The car comes by. A big limousine comes by. And the window goes down, and the guy in the back goes, need a lift? And he goes, yeah! And he goes, go for it, man. Your future's in front of you. Go for it. Asphyxiation is going to be where you have oxygen starvation. Like carbon monoxide. Now we know that our blood cells want to carry oxygen in. They also want to carry what out?
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide. So we have our helpful red blood cell. He's going to be bringing in carbon or oxygen. And then he's going to be bringing out CO2. RBC. Now CO2, of course, is two oxygens with one carbon. This looks very similar to what? Oxygen. So these guys can be carried readily. This can be released readily, as well as this can be released readily, because they're very similar, aren't they? Now interspersed within that, a CO, which is going to be called what? Carbon monoxide. Does this look like that? No. This will not be able to be shed by the RBCs as readily as this. So, if it's not being shed very readily and it goes back into the system, is it going to be able to pick up oxygen? No, because it's still there. To pick up oxygen, you've got to have this guy go off. This guy's got to be able to get on. So therefore, if you build up with these, are you building up with oxygen? No, and you go through a asphyxiation. Now, if you're in your car, which is difficult to do, by the way, in these days, because we've got these catalytic converters, so if it's a new car, don't even try it. But you have to get an old Cadillac or something if you want to off yourself, just so you know. So, difficult to do now. But if you were caught in the middle of your asphyxiation, and then they pulled you out into air, would you still have this problem? For a while? For quite a while, right? Until you got you got the red blood cells to either die or just get rid of the CO2. So either way, it's a bad situation. So we can also aspirate, as we mentioned with that one woman with her tooth. And it's going to be more likely where?
Right lung.
We
also have dyspnea, which is just going to be labored or painful breathing. And we have Rawls, which we described as our hair. You know that crackling if you have what condition?
Pleurisy.
Pleurisy. Good job. You can also hear other things like turbulence if you have pneumonia, for instance. So we'd be hearing different things, such as a turbulence would be if you take your hand and put it over your ear and rub your ear. Okay, we can also have, isn't that cool? They're called Rawls. And there used to be a famous singer, Lou Rawls.
You'll never know.
You'll never know.
long as you live. Son, maybe I like you. Is that it? Oh, cool.